from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, Democrats threaten to pack the court, the politicization of the Supreme Court, and the call for herd immunity in response to COVID-19. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Reagan Republican, and Christ follower. Back when Nancy Pelosi's Congress passed Obamacare, the Speaker famously said, "We need to pass it so we can see what's in it." And now Joe Biden is taking the same tactic with the Supreme Court, telling reporters this week that we'll find out his stand on packing the court when he gets elected. Even during the vice presidential debate on Wednesday, Kamala Harris refused to say if she supported the move or not. Joining Family Research Council President Tony Perkins to discuss the Supreme Court and how liberals view it as a political branch is Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska.
Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
Well, let me just start with this. A broader question about why are the courts so important? Why has this been so politicized?
Well, I think going all the way back in 1987, there are many on the left. It's not everybody on the left. There are a lot of Nebraska Democrats who are still reasonable, but there are many elite leftists who believe in government. They don't necessarily affirm the core American idea of universal human dignity and therefore limited government, because our freedom of speech, religion, press, assembly, protest, etc., the great five cluster of freedoms in the First Amendment, those are pre-governmental rights. And we believe in limited government because we believe in that universal dignity. But if on the left, you instead believe government should be the center of everybody's life and attention and conversation and alliances, then they like the idea of a super legislature as well. And that is kind of how many of them have viewed the courts for the last 4 or 5 decades. And so when they have somebody like Amy Barrett before them, an extraordinary jurist who understands the modest, humble role of a judge, they're threatened by that because they want to call everybody else an activist, since their view is actually that courts are supposed to be activists.
But Senator, you've made some really good points in the past on that topic by saying that Congress really has facilitated this super legislature, if you will, the nine black robes.
Yeah, I mean, the founders believed in distinguishing between vertical and horizontal separation of powers and checks and balances. And at the so that means state and local government is where most governance functions should happen, and a limited number at the federal. But at the federal level, you distinguish between legislative, Article 1, executive, Article 2, and judicial, Article 3. And we have an impotent legislature for a really long time, where every single decade you see the growth of executive branch unilateralism, you see the growth of the administrative state, and you see the growth of activist courts, largely because the legislature underreaches. There are a lot of people in the Congress who want the job forever more than they really want to use the role to steward their responsibilities for the American people while they're there. And so if Congress doesn't solve problems, it makes sense that the executive branch, it's not okay, but it makes sense that the executive branch would try to fill that vacuum, and then courts would try to net out the differences. And so we have both an Article 2 and an Article 3 branch that overreach because our Article 1 branch doesn't do its job.
Well, and part of that is because when you take hard votes, you have to, when you take on tough issues, you have a record. And that sometimes, if you are on the wrong side of it, could be a hindrance to reelection.
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, there's a lot. I'm one of 8 or 9 out of 100 in the Senate who's never been a politician before running for the Senate. And before I got there, I really believed, as I think a lot of my neighbors believe, that one of the biggest problems in Washington is a bunch of people who are too power hungry. In a weird way, what we really have is a bunch of legislators who are so fame hungry that they're power averse. There are a lot of people who don't want to exercise power because if you do, you're going to have to net out some trade-offs. You're going to have to explain yourself to the American people, and they may not reelect you. So a lot of people in the Congress would rather not do anything to seemingly not offend anybody. But what really ends up happening is a Congress that isn't trusted because it doesn't tackle the biggest political problems that are facing the American people.
Let me – I'm going to play a clip from last night's debate where the vice president – again, just like the president did with Joe Biden, he asked Kamala Harris about the court packing threat.
You've refused to answer the question. Joe Biden has refused to answer the question. So I think the American people would really like to know, if Judge Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed to the Supreme Court of the United States, Are you and Joe Biden, if somehow you win this election, going to pack the Supreme Court to get your way?
I'm so glad we went through a little history lesson. Let's do that a little more. In 1864...
Well, I'd like you to answer the question.
No, Mr. Yes, Vice President, I'm speaking. The American people deserve to make the decision about who will be the next president of the United States. And then that person can select who will serve for a lifetime on the highest court of our land.
Was that an answer?
She went back to 160 years to not answer the question, are you going to try to pack the court? I think the number one headline of last night, and it's an echo of what happened in the presidential debate, a week and a half ago, is that they will not, the Biden and Harris ticket will not answer if they plan to pack the Supreme Court, which pretty much tells you that they are very much online with the woke desire to make the Supreme Court 13 or 15 people to import some of the craziest radical ideas from campus into our jurisprudence. The idea that speech you don't like is violence is crazy and anti-American. It's also really, really popular on campus right now. And that's the kind of stuff that I think you'd see on the Supreme Court, that kind of attack on the First Amendment, on religious liberty, on free speech, on free assembly, if they make a Supreme Court of 13 or 15 people. And I think that's the number one issue on the ballot November 3rd. And it's why maintaining a majority in the U.S. Senate is the most important election before us.
And Senator, to that point, part of the motivation there obviously has to be the judges and justices that have been placed onto not only the Supreme Court, but appellate courts and lower courts in the last 3.5 years that the Senate has been a part of confirming. These are constitutionalists that are bound to the Constitution, and that is frustrating to the left.
Yeah. It is the most important thing that's happened in government in the last 3.5 years. Is 200 new textualists and originalists on the courts, with almost a third of those are appellate courts vacancies that were filled. And then obviously the two onto the Supreme Court, and hopefully having Amy Barrett join their number in the next few weeks. That is the most important positive development in the U.S. government these last 3 years. And the left is just apoplectic at the idea that you'd put people on the courts who put on a black robe and understand the humility that's enshrined in you cloaking your personal partisan or policy preferences.
Let me ask you this. When you talk about this attack on the faith, we're hoping it doesn't happen, but most likely it will. What does this tell us more beyond the court about the left and their view of, quite frankly, a majority of Americans who think their faith, their faith is important to them, and they act based upon that faith?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many basic American civic truths that we should back up and talk about in a time like this. I mean, unfortunately, we've not been doing basic civics in the country since the late 1960s. But there is such a bizarre view that somehow people who believe something and are active in public life, trying to love their neighbor and serve, are violating the American idea. No, the American idea is precisely that, even though we might differ about really important things like theology, we don't think that the purpose of government is to net those kinds of things out. The purpose of government is to maintain a framework for ordered liberty, so Americans who differ about theology know that we're all protected from violence about matters like that, and we can actually break bread together and sit around a table and argue and try to persuade one another. Maybe even people will shout in their arguments in the public square. That's not desirable, but it's what our system precisely envisions as the way that you preclude violence in the public square, so that the more important things, the matters of the heart, matters of the soul, matters of conviction and conversion and persuasion and creed, those are the things we get to wrestle about, but free from violence. That's what government's for. It's not to take people who have creed and say, you actually have to be banished from public life. And there's just so much about the elite left that has just lost touch with not just the history of American civics, but the way regular people live their lives.
Yeah, that is so insightful, because if we can't come to consensus through a process by which we respect one another, even though we disagree, and we can argue about those things, but we if we can't voice our opinions and our thoughts and our views, that's where it spills over into the streets, where there's the violence and the unrest. Senator, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us. And obviously, we're going to be watching very, very closely next week.
Thanks, Tony. Have a great day, and thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Senator Ben Sass of Nebraska. All right, coming up next, we'll be joined by another senator. Senator Ted Cruz joins us next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Each week until the election, FRC and FRC Action will host a special Pray, Vote, Stand broadcast to equip you to pray, vote, and stand for biblical truth. We'll have experts, elected leaders, and Christian leaders join us for these half-hour programs that will help you see through the fog that's been created by the biased lenses of the mainstream media. To watch the broadcasts, visit PrayVoteStand.org.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. Hey, let me once again encourage you to take the challenge to pray, vote, and stand. We're coming up on one of the most important elections in the history of our republic. Take the challenge to pray, to vote, to stand. Text me the word VOTE, V-O-T-E, to 53445. That number again, 53445, the word VOTE, and you'll be right there in the midst of the challenge. Pray, vote, stand, or go to TonyPerkins.com. You can take it there as well. All right, we just touched on this topic with Senator Ben Sass about why the court has become so important, so politicized. Well, my next guest has actually written a book on it. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas is not only a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, but he also clerked at the Supreme Court for the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And he is the author of a brand new book, very timely, I should say, One Vote Away, How a Single Supreme Court Seat Can Change History. Senator Ted Cruz, welcome back to the program.
Tony, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me once again.
Well, a book coming out about the significance of one seat. Holding a copy of the book right here, One Vote Away, How a Single Supreme Court Seat Can Change History. And we're seeing history unfold right before us, are we not?
Undoubtedly. I think the nomination of Judge Barrett may well be the single most important decision President Trump has made. You know, this book I wrote this spring and summer, and when I was home on COVID lockdown and was sitting in my living room, grabbed the laptop and wrote the book. And obviously I didn't know we would have a Supreme Court vacancy in October, but I knew we'd have a presidential election in December. And I think judicial nominations and the Supreme Court in particular is the single most important issue in this election. And so the book was designed to really delve into that and explain why. And the book is not, it's not an academic book. It's not an abstract book. It's a very practical, real book where each chapter addresses a different constitutional liberty. There's a chapter on free speech, a chapter on religious liberty, a chapter on the Second Amendment. And I tell war stories. As you know, before I was in the Senate, I was a Supreme Court litigator. What I did for a living was argue cases in front of the Supreme Court. And so I take readers inside the court, behind the curtain, to really understand what's going on, who the justices are, and how these fundamental liberties, that they impact your life so much.
Yeah, in fact, you write in the book, quote, God may endow us with certain unalienable rights, but whether we enjoy them depends on 9 judges, the priest of the robe, who have the last say in our system of government. And that is the effect of the court. They can actually rewrite the Constitution with their opinions,
yep.
And they have.
They have, and if you look at constitutional right after constitutional right, the book discusses many of the big landmark decisions. And it's stunning how many of them were 5-4, that we're just one vote away from losing our fundamental liberty. So, for example, on the chapter on religious liberty, one of the cases I talk about is the Texas Ten Commandments case. We have in Texas on the state capitol grounds a monument to the Ten Commandments. It's been there since 1961. An individual plaintiff, an atheist, who happens to be a homeless man, filed a lawsuit arguing you can't have the Ten Commandments anywhere on public land. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and we won 5-4. That means there were four justices prepared to order, send in the bulldozers, knock down the monument. This is how fragile our fundamental rights are, and we're one vote away from losing them.
So, Senator, how can folks get a copy of your book, One Vote Away, How a Single Supreme Court Seat Can Change History?
So you can get it on Amazon, you can get it on Barnes & Noble, you can get it anywhere you get books. And I got to say, Tony, it's been incredible. The book came out last week, and it rose to become the number one bestseller in the country on Amazon. And so it's I think for a lot of folks, they know the Supreme Court's important. They know the issues there are important, but it's confusing. It's hard to understand what's really going on. And this book is designed to be understandable, to make sense. By the way, this book, I think is very good also for students, for high school students, even for precocious junior high kids. They could get a lot out of it. But for any person, you don't have to be a lawyer to enjoy this book. If you want to know more about what's going on at the Supreme Court, if you care about our Bill of Rights, if you want to know more about this election, what the stakes are, if God forbid Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi win, what the stakes are for the country, this book is designed to really give you the information as you're talking to your friends and family and neighbors, and the confirmation battle for Judge Barrett. If you want to understand really what the stakes are, this book is designed to help you in that.
All right, Senator, we're almost out of time, but speaking of Judge Barrett, what can we anticipate next week when she's in the committee that you're a part of?
Well, I think the Democrats are going to try to turn it into a political circus like they did for Justice Kavanaugh. But we're going to move forward. I don't think the Democrats are going to be successful in stopping this nomination. I believe we have the votes. And I believe we will confirm Judge Barrett as Justice Barrett before the end of the month, before Election Day.
All right. Well, we hope to talk to you maybe next week as that process unfolds. Senator Ted Cruz, best of luck on the new book. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you, my friend. God bless.
You can find out more about Senator Cruz, as well as how to get a copy of his book, One Vote Away, when you visit TonyPerkins.com. That's TonyPerkins.com.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership on our nation by the lack of godly men. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy of Man to Man wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. As we work our way through the eighth month of various COVID-19 lockdowns by state governors, something called the Great Barrington Declaration is gaining steam. With over 5,000 medical and public health scientists and over 10,600 medical practitioners signing on, we thought it was important to talk with Dr. Andrew Bostom about it. Dr. Bostom is an epidemiologist and associate professor of family medicine at Brown University. Here's Tony Perkins.
Dr. Bostrom, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me on, Tony.
All right, so tell our folks the Great Barrington Declaration. What is it? Why is it there?
Well, it was put together by three leading international infectious disease epidemiologists. And the crux of it, in their own words, is that quote, adopting measures to protect the vulnerable should be the central aim of public health responses to COVID-19, unquote. And the reason they argue for this is the great devastation that lockdown policies are clearly producing, both in the short and long term. They believe very strongly that this is counter to traditional epidemiologic understandings. In particular, Tony, they would be very consistent with the late
great D.A. Henderson, who was the head of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and really spearheaded the drive to eradicate smallpox internationally. He was vehemently opposed to lockdowns. This idea had surfaced back in the early 2000s, and he wrote a paper, was lead author on a paper, which condemned lockdowns for respiratory epidemics, respiratory virus epidemics, condemned the whole idea of coercive masking and things that he just felt did not work. And his main point, and I think that's the point in this document, is that, you know, if the Hippocratic Oath is above all, do no harm, the epidemiologic equivalent is above all, do not stoke fear, and encourage people to live as normally as possible. And I think that's the purpose of this document, and also to not ignore traditional epidemiologic principles, like the idea that the population that is less vulnerable to severe morbidity and mortality, much less vulnerable, be allowed to circulate and to go to their jobs and to get educated and build up herd immunity, natural herd immunity. Now, this can be augmented if there is a safe and successful a vaccine that's developed, and I know there are earnest efforts toward that end. But until then, the social and really physical and economic harms and health harms of lockdowns far outweigh any transient benefit. They basically can sort of transiently protect the flow of sick patients to a hospital, but they don't reduce the overall number of infections. And by delaying the ability of this less vulnerable segment, this vast less vulnerable segment of the population to develop herd immunity, it makes them more dangerous to the truly vulnerable. See, the beauty of herd immunity is that once a person develops herd immunity, obviously they're immune to reinfection themselves, or if they get reinfected, it's a very mild infection. But they're much less likely to transmit the disease.
Right.
So it's a double-edged sword.
Right. And this is one of the few occasions where I'm proud to say I'm a part of the herd. I've had the virus, and I'm no longer, susceptible to it, and I'm not going to pass it along. But this document is very straightforward, very short, easy to read, folks. You can look at it, tonyperkins.com. I got a link there. But just to pull a couple of the points that you said, Doctor, out of this, it says it starts with this, the damaging physical and mental health impacts of the prevailing COVID-19 policies. And that's this, this lockdown. It goes on to say current lockdown policies are producing devastating effects on short and long-term public health, lower childhood vaccination rates, worsening cardiovascular disease outcomes, fewer cancer screenings, deteriorating mental health, leading to greater excess mortality in years to come. And it goes on to say keeping students out of school is a grave injustice. And then it goes into the herd mentality. Now, it also pulls out that there are those that are at higher risk, and we need to take actions to protect those at higher risk and make accommodation. But to your point earlier, everyone else who is in the less susceptible category should be able to go about life as normal.
Right, and I think one of the points of emphasis that gets lost, Tony, is that by allowing the less vulnerable out in society, and instead of locking them down, not only do they avoid the direct harms of the lockdowns in terms of their own economic and social health, you're allowing them to become infected and generate herd immunity, and ultimately that will protect the elderly as long as the elderly are sheltered in this period where the less vulnerable are basically becoming infected with mild infections. If you're constantly locking everybody down and going through cycles of lockdown, you delay this process and you allow the contact between the two groups to be in such a way that it causes more death.
Right. So you're delaying the inevitable. But in the meantime, you're doing a lot more damage. If you just kind of, all right, let's be reasonable about this. Let's take the necessary precautions, but go about life as normal as we can. We've got to keep the economy going. We've got to keep groceries on the shelves. We've got to take care of those in society that cannot move about. This is crazy what we're doing. And what I find, you know, fascinating about this, encouraging by this, is that this is not coming from the right. This is a mixture, but there's a lot of kind of people on here that have signed this that I wouldn't agree with on a lot of stuff. But the science speaks very clearly.
Dr. Gupta, Dr. Sunitra Gupta from Oxford, Dr. Martin Kolder from Harvard. I mean, they're proud academic leftists. I mean, there's no question about that. Dr. Bhattacharya is I would say is a little more of a centrist, but absolutely they are two of the leading promoters of this idea and this and who composed the document are proudly avowed academic leftists, no question.
Final question for you, Dr. Balsam. Is this catching on? Is this getting people's attention?
I think it is. I think it is. There was actually I was surprised to see it was sort of semi-critical, but it was a more balanced story than you would have expected from the BBC about this. So I thought that was a very good sign, and of course beyond the BBC, it's getting some more balanced attention. I think it's going to be viciously attacked in this country by the supporters of Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx, because let's face it, Tony, at a certain point this becomes an academic or public health embarrassment. That this alternative view has been out there. It's a very reasonable view. It's actually it's a very traditional view. I think that they dig in. People that are embarrassed dig in.
Yeah. Dr. Andrew Balsam, thank you so much for joining us. Great conversation. Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.